How much time does it take to recite Surah Al-Yasin? Half hour, 45 minutes. Most of you know how to recite the Quran. Read it in English. The better you read it in Arabic, read it in English. But recite it, brothers and sisters. Recite it from the day on. Pick a time. Get up in the morning after Fajr. Start reciting it. Your day will be such that you won't even imagine how that day will go. It will go to such a degree. You will be surprised beyond your wildest dream and expectations, believe me.
You're tuned in to KBOO Portland. This has been Islamic Point of View. I want to remind you that we actually have some announcements coming up. Keep in mind that we have the pledge drive for our spring pledge, or winter pledge drive for here at KBOO. And it is one of your ways that you can support this program and other programs that you happen to enjoy on this station. Also, too, on Friday, February 13th, we have Dr. Rafiq Beacom, a professor in management of strategy, coming to Portland State University at 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. doing a lecture on the leadership of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. On Saturday, February 14th, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., he will be doing a conflict management for from an Islamic perspective workshop for 16-year-olds and older. This will be at MET. And on Saturday, February 14th, from 5:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., he will have another lecture at Portland State University Hoffman Hall on stress management from Islamic perspective. We now invite you to stay tuned to Pathways.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Divination Foundation, offering the enlightened decision-making system to help people and organizations make the right moves at the right time. More information at www.divination.com. That's divination.com.
Good morning and welcome to Pathways. This is Tom Park, your host this week. And folks, this week's going to be a bit of a treasure, okay? I have with me this morning Dr. Robert Foreman. Good morning, Robert.
Hi, nice to be here.
Folks, this gentleman is a professor in our wonderful city of New York at the, is it New York U?
City University of New York.
City University of New York. And you're a professor in comparative religions?
Mm-hmm. And I study mysticism and spirituality. That's my main focus.
Don't let me put the words in your mouth. Give us just a little capsule of who you are. Obviously, you've been on your journey a while.
Yeah, I started meditating in 1969. I haven't missed a day. I became a professor. I got my PhD in comparative religions and mysticism, and I've written 10 books. And I started in 1996. I started the Forge Institute, which brings together spiritual teachers, leaders, and writers, kind of organization of spiritual teachers. And then I wrote this book, Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, and it's been out for a little less than a year at this point.
Folks, so in my hand, Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, subtitle, A Journey of Discovery, Snow, and Jazz in the Soul. I expect we're going to hear what that means, because I still don't know, folks. But we're going to study about all kinds of things in the soul today. So, Robert, it's not what it's cracked up to be. You say that based on lots of interactions with great teachers, or more your personal experience?
Well, the book is in part a memoir, in part a look-see at my own life. And what happened to me was in 1972, something happened to me in a long meditation course. I was on a 9-month meditation retreat. Something happened to me, and I could go into detail about exactly what the steps were. But the upshot was that before that time, If I would have described my experience to you, it would have been, I'd be talking to you, I'd be, looking at you as I am right now, but also behind that would be I just came off a trip, and behind that would be, don't forget to pick up milk, and behind that would be a snatch of tune. But what happened after that time in 72 was that silence, a sense of open, vast, delicious silence, replaced all that background stuff. And that started in January the 4th of 1972, and it's been with me ever since, and it's grown a good bit. So that was the beginning of my life, and it was the beginning of my life quest, because the thing for me, Tom, was that despite the fact that this experience comes on, I had had so many fantasies about enlightenment was going to make you this sort of really happy or this sort of superhuman. It's going to make you really, just all your work is going to go well. It's going to make your relationships healthy. None of that happened. And I didn't know what to make of it. I was struggling with anxiety before that time. I kept struggling with anxiety after the silence came on. I was struggling with depression. I was struggling with relationships. After that time, I continued to struggle with all that. And so when this thing comes on, I thought, for the first half an hour or so, I thought, oh boy, this is enlightenment. Wow, wow, wow. And then within a half an hour, I realized, wait a minute, I'm not happy. Wait a minute, what's going on here? I'm still anxious. This doesn't make any sense. And so I really struggled with this. And I ultimately decided after about a year of kind of asking, is it, isn't it, is it? I finally decided, look, stop asking the darn question. I don't know. And I put it out of my mind until I went to graduate school and I started reading the traditional texts about what enlightenment was. And lo and behold, the traditional texts are describing something remarkably similar. My favorite passage, can I tell you that?
Please do.
My favorite passage comes from the Upanishads, and it describes two birds that sit on a branch, one of which is doing its thing, eating, making noise, pecking. The other bird sits on that same branch, just witnessing, it says. The first bird, the passage says, is our individual self. The second bird is our universal self. So as opposed to thinking, as I had, that enlightenment was going to make you happy, what this passage is describing, and I could describe it from lots of other passages and other traditions, but what this passage is describing is not a shift in personality. It doesn't necessarily make you happy. It doesn't necessarily make you ego-free. It means that you now have this witnessing consciousness at the same time that you're doing your life. In other words, you're in your life, you're doing what you do, you're living your life, but at the same time, what's holding it or beholding it is this open sense of vastness, this open sense of silence. And lo and behold, that's what was happening to me. So I read lots and lots of different traditions about this stuff. And I began to think, I think I, and probably many of us that are listening to this show, have this sort of fantasy life about what enlightenment is going to be like. And I think maybe the experience doesn't meet up to what we hear. And then I started hearing about all these gurus that were getting themselves in trouble and getting themselves in sexual problems and, committing fraud and, doing awful things. And I have to say to myself, wait a minute, I presume these guys are enlightened. And if so, for them, these Indian guys that were coming over, it also doesn't seem to be making them the kind of person I think we all want to be. And so I think we have this fantasy, and that's what enlightenment is cracked up to be. I think we have this fantasy of what enlightenment is. And I think the actual experience is something much more normal, much more human, as it were, much more organic than I had imagined. It's not to say it's nothing. It's not to say it's not of value, but it is to say it's not what it's cracked up to be. It doesn't live up to the fantasy. It doesn't live up to the hype, as it were. Yeah?
Yes, I get you. Very good, Robert. Yeah. I also get that enlightenment, as it's been used by some people who've had their flavor of experience, you've had a flavor of experience, mm-hmm. may not be exactly or only what yours was. So I recognize, I honor that you had an experience which definitely aligns with a lot of criterion of enlightenment that mm-hmm. you've found in your studies. Mm-hmm. But there may well be other aspects of enlightenment that went beyond what you've experienced.
Oh, of course, there may. And by the way, what I've described is what happened in the beginning, and that was that's all been permanent, but it's grown and grown and grown. And I think what you
how
also...
How so? I'd love to know. How does
great.
It grow?
I think the most important shift that happened, and this was about 20, 25 years after that first one came on. That was 72, so this is mid-90s, is a sense of what many of the traditions call unity. Now, the experience of unity, I can describe the way it first came on. I was driving in a mountain valley in Colorado, coming back from a retreat, and it was as if there was a cloud around me. Now, it wasn't a cloud, but it was as if there was this widespread sense of a something. I could almost touch it. And I realized it went everywhere I saw it went. And this cloud also went into the mountains. And then before I knew it, I was realizing that the cloud also went inside me. So that there was this sense of a stuff almost, of as if a something that you could, as I say, almost touch. And that something was unquestionably the sort of expansion of the silence that I had first felt, but now I could see it everywhere, touch it everywhere. There's a sense of touch or taste or smell of this stuff. And so all of that together began to sound like what the Christians call the prayer of unity, what Maharishi Mahesh called unity consciousness. And I think that sort of thing I also see in many of the texts, in many of the traditions around the world.
Yeah? Yes, indeed. I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
These sound like facets of enlightenment that you're discussing. Not necessarily the universe of enlightenment, but facets of enlightenment.
Could be.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Could be.
Okay, so in the book, people that are hungry, this is something that's going to feed them? Is it a guidebook? Is it a watch out for these kind of missteps books? What is it?
Well, in an interesting way, I'm getting a lot of very good feedback from the book, and there's like 30 people have written on Amazon now. It's really quite gratifying. I think what it is it is one man's experience told with the deepest honesty he could tell a story. And that honesty, I think, is itself a lesson. Is itself a kind of inspiration. I can't tell you how many people have written me personal emails. My emails at the back of the book. People have written me emails saying, thank you for writing this book. It both confirms my struggles and my struggles to come to terms with my own life and many of my own experiences, but it also is a kind of invitation. And it's an invitation to be straight and honest and real with oneself and straight and honest and real with other people. The second half of the book, after I state out the problem of enlightenment not living up to the fantasy, the second half of the book is, well, how do we get to a more authentic, real life, the kind of life I think we're actually all after? And there, the focus of that, all the chapters there, the focus of them is, I think honesty is the key facet of becoming real.
Honesty is a difficult word. Give me some peel it back a little bit about honesty.
I like your questions, by the way, Tom. honesty is a difficult word. Of course, we all think that we're honest. Well, the first time I noticed this was when I went to psychotherapy about 10 years after this experience began, but this shift began, by the way. And I went into psychotherapy because my life was not coming out very well. I was, in fact, having a panic attack, though I didn't know it at the time. And I began to realize that I was afraid of my professors. But what I was really afraid of, I discovered after about 8 months or a year with my therapist, was what I was really afraid of was my father. And that was what I was really running from. And the statement to myself, it's not the professor I'm afraid of, it's my dad. A statement like that, where you kind of duck underneath the way you thought your life was structured, the way I said something there that was deeply honest. And that honesty was itself transformative. And the reason I put it in this book is that the quality of life that comes after you say something to yourself or perhaps to a good friend, the quality of life that comes after you've said that is the same sense of openness, the same sense of lightness, the same sense of authentic presence that comes or came for me with that shift into enlightenment, with the silence that we might get in meditation, with the silence that we might get in our prayer life. I think that there's a connection there, and that's what's really cool. It's really cool because I think that what we're really after is that kind of a life of openness, of non-defensiveness, of freedom. And that sense of freedom is in fact the same kind of thing. It's the same, as it were, felt tone that comes with the silence of meditation or with the silence of enlightenment. Yeah? So that the book is an attempt to be that honest. It's an attempt to say what's really going on so that one man's experience of one man's attempt to say what's really been true, one man's attempt to say what's really been going on in his own life, where his own real struggles are, makes it safer for other people to be that honest with themselves and to be that honest with one another. And in that sense, the book is very much a teaching. It is a memoir, it is a story, and it's also a fair amount of research involved, but mostly it's an attempt to be deeply honest, and honest about where my struggles have been, honest about what's real, honest about where I'm good and bad and whatnot. So, yeah, I think there's a teaching in it.
Okay. Research. When you say research, it comes to mind your travels around the world. I mean, you traveled and studied with, in monasteries, I take it? Probably with great leaders of these different faiths and disciplines. You've been, the Far East and India. Is this the research you refer to?
Oh, I have been. I lived in India, as I've told you. I also have spent some time in Japan and Korea. And I've spoken in countries all around the world. My main research, however, has been textual. I was a trained graduate in graduate school. I probably have read 2,000 books on spirituality and mysticism. So that's really where the stuff... I mean, mostly when I go to foreign countries, I talk as opposed to them talking to me. But, you know, in the course of my graduate career, in the course of my life, I've probably read 2,000 books. And what I've been seeing is that there is a kind of consistency around the world that I did not quite expect. I expected the traditions to be more profoundly different than I think they turn out to be when you talk about the mystical side of these different traditions. And so that I think I can identify this. In fact, some of the research that's in Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, I look at the description of enlightenment by a Christian woman named Bernadette Roberts and Meister Eckhart, another Christian. I look at it in the Dhammapada in Buddhism. I look at it in Hinduism, Shankara, the Upanishads. So that the book is not a research book. It's not an academic book. It's really designed for folks like you and me. But there's a lot of research behind it, and it's in that was the research that began to say, you know, I think enlightenment may not be what we'd fantasized.
So speaking of fantasies and the dreamy view of enlightenment from movies, from books, whatever, people always associate that with spending time with a live teacher and having experiences that are that, you know, ignited, that there's two human beings involved. It sounds like yours are mostly with books and with
I'm sorry. I didn't quite understand. That's kind of what you were asking. My teacher was Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and I spent...
Thank you. Oh, this is a big... I didn't know this.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, that was the meditation retreat I was on for 9 months when all this shift began to happen. He was my teacher, and I've tried quite a number of different paths. TM, the technique that he taught, Transcendental Meditation, is the path that he taught, and that's been my path right along, and I've always done it. I've tried other practices. TM has always worked for me, so that's the one that I do, and that's the one that led to this shift that I've been describing.
So you must have spent time with him in the earlier days.
Oh, yeah, quite a long time. Yeah. I've probably spent 2 years with him, on and off.
Mostly here or India?
Back in, this was 1969, 70, 71, too, like that. The first time I saw him was in the United States, then I saw him in Spain, then I saw him in Italy, then I saw him in Switzerland, and frankly, I've never seen him in India. He had an ashram, but by the time I knew him, his ashram, there were too many of us to fit in that ashram, so we'd find hotels in off seasons and whatnot and go and meditate our brains out.
Those were quite the days.
Yes,
did you ever bump into the Beatles?
Oh, no, they were before my time.
They were before your time?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I thought they drifted into those late 60s days.
Yeah. Well, I only started in 69, and I was really involved with the movement between 70 and 75 or so.
Did you know Deepak Chopra in those days?
You know, I actually did know him, yeah.
I thought you must have.
Yeah, I met
because
him. He's a wonderful guy.
He was really
He was dead center in the thing. He was quite the player, yeah. And we were all sort of amazed when he fell away and did his own thing, yeah.
Yes, I remember in those early days, the talk was that, he was the likely successor.
He was. You know, Marshy found a new successor, a fellow they call the Raj right now. And I saw him just about 2 months ago, and I must say I was quite impressed with the guy.
Very good.
Yeah.
Is Maharishi alive still?
I'm sorry?
Is Maharishi still in the body?
No, he passed about 2-3 years ago now.
I beg your pardon. I didn't know.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay, so what else could our folks benefit from today? Here, we have you here, and you obviously are major, major authority. And how about Christianity? You studied Christianity quite a bit, yes?
It is not my field. I've studied Hinduism and Buddhism. I've taught Christianity. I can teach a little bit. I can talk a little about Christianity.
But the mystical side of Christianity.
That's the part that I know.
I'd love to hear about
that. Well, I wrote a book on Meister Eckhart, and one of the things that surprised me about him was that he describes what I would consider to be two or three different experiences. One he calls rapture. And that experience is a temporary experience. It's like, you know, he describes Paul being enraptured to the third heaven. And that's a very interesting experience when he describes it. But then what's really interesting, and most people haven't noticed, is he describes an experience which he calls the Geburt, which means the birth of the Son in the soul. That's the Son of God in the soul. And what he means by that is that as the kind of shift that I think I'm describing happens, that it is, from his point of view, a way to think about it is that what Christ found, which was a connection with God, or in my vocabulary, the vastness, what Christ found was the same thing that an individual can find, being born in his own soul. So in that sense, we can have the birth of Christ in our soul. That's his language.
When you say the Son of God, which S-O-N or S-U-N? Which would be?
We have the pun. German doesn't have the same pun, so it's S-O-N. The Son of God, yeah?
Very good.
Birth of Christ in the soul. But then he also calls another shift that I've described to you as unity. He describes that shift as the Durchbruch, the breakthrough. In other words, we break through so that before we were seeing things as separate, we were seeing God and the individual as separate in some way. But in the breakthrough, you come to see yourself as being united with the Godhead, as is the language that he has for it. In other words, you're united with this sense of the One, the Infinite, and that sense of the One is a unitive experience. So when I described the cloud to you earlier of my own experience, I think Eckhart is describing something rather like that as a breakthrough. And the breakthrough is when we have this experience of the Infinite seen everywhere, we have broken through from separation to unity. I think that's exactly the kind of experience Eckhart is describing.
So there's so many paths of meditation.
Yeah.
Apparently, you feel like the path of meditation you pursued actually was in line with what's happened to you, with what's developed for you. Is it a result of your meditation practice?
Oh, deep question. I think what meditation does, I don't think meditation can hand this stuff to you. I think meditation helps. I think what it did for me and what it does for a lot of people is it kind of, as it were, plows the ground or sets up the context. But I think that experiences that are really deep shifts, there's something well beyond human control in that. The Christian word for that is grace. And I think there is something like grace that brings this stuff on. You know, the distinction you often hear is between work and effort, or what's his name? Will and... I can't think of the other word. So between work and effort... Oh, will and grace. That's the cartoon. That's the joke I was thinking.
I didn't know if that's where you're going.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
I
think it's between will and grace. So I think that the practice of meditation helps set up the ground of this. But I don't know that it can create this. I think one of the things that we have to come to terms with is whatever's happening because of meditation, whatever is happening in lives, these are very deep shifts and well beyond anything we can control. We can help. We can do things that...
We can help?
Yes, of course. We can help. We can plow the ground. We can set up the situation. But we can't make it happen. We can't make these things happen. So I feel profoundly grateful that this sort of stuff happened to me. I hope I have and can live up to it. But it's not mine. It's not something that I own. In fact, it's not even me as an individual. Really, the discovery of silence, or the vastness, is, again, my favorite word for it. The discovery of silence is the discovery of something that really is not Robert-ish. It's not about me. It's not about an individual, per se. But rather, it's a discovery of something, I think, that transcends each of us as an individual.
I got to ask, because in this show context, there's been a lot of reference to this over the years.
Yeah.
Do you see experiences of, like, a divine... communication, a light, any sound or spoken something? Is there any? Do you see any divine communication?
Me personally,
in a superhuman form. I'm not talking thought transference. I'm not talking burning bushes. I'm talking about actual light or sound of a different realm of consciousness that communicates to human beings? Anything like that happen, like in the silence and in the unity experience? Is there an element of divine light?
I would say yes, but again, I don't want this conversation to be about me personally. I don't want this conversation to go off on what I personally have experienced like that. Okay. But I think the lesson of the book is really about bringing the value of the infinite into our everyday life. So whether somebody has the experience of the divine or not, I think more important is, does somebody live a deeply true and authentic life? That is much more interesting to me. And the message of the book is about how to become more authentic and more real.
In case my listeners have this question in mind, I thought it might be of interest to some others of us.
Yeah, it is. It is. But it's not something I'd like to talk about all that much.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got a few minutes left. Yeah. And maybe you want to have a story or two you want to tell? You've had an incredible life here, Robert. You want to have a story or two of some of this incredible journey.
Well, let me tell you a story about how I discovered that one could be honest with ones in relationships. I think that relationships are an undervalued part of this whole spiritual path. I think relationships can be great. So the story I want to tell you has to do with the time that I was thinking I was going to divorce my wife. And in fact, I asked her to divorce. We'd probably been married for about 25 years at the time. And it had been a struggle. The marriage had been a struggle. And I told her I wanted to get divorced. And a friend of ours happened to be in town that day. And so he heard this. And he sat us down and we just talked. She and I talked and I told her about why and whatnot. And finally he said to me, "Are you feeling what she's saying?" And I said, "Yes, I'm feeling her." Let me hang on one second. I would say, "Yes, I'm feeling her very deeply." And I had this ability to feel her like from my belly in a very Buddha-like place. In other words, I was feeling her as a spiritual being to another spiritual being. And he said, "No, are you feeling what she's feeling?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, she's probably feeling rejected right now. Have you ever felt rejected?" "Oh, yeah, I hate that, you know." And then I switched because of the questions that he had asked me. And I said to her, "Oh, are you feeling that?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Oh, my God, you mean I've been making you feel that way?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Oh, my God, I've been using my spiritual life as a kind of distancing tool. It's kept me from you." And she said, "You darn straight, you know, that's exactly what it was." And it was so opening between the two of us. And the key again was I was honest with myself and ultimately honest with her. And that honesty allowed the relationship to really cook in a way that it never had before. I was using my spiritual life. I was using this shift that had happened to me as a way to keep distance from her, as a way to keep distance from others too, no doubt. And I think that all of us on the spiritual path can use our spiritual lives as a way to keep others kind of at bay. And in that sense, I think that the honesty I was able to find with her was a good tool for bringing the value of enlightenment into the very relationship I was in. And I had not heard anybody talk about it quite this way. And I think that bringing the openness, bringing the truth-telling, bringing the honesty that comes with enlightenment per se, or with our meditation life per se, can be of enormous value in allowing our relationships to really thrive. And as lots of people have said, relationships are where the rubber meets the road and all this.
Amen. Robert, a pleasure. A pleasure having you on today. A pleasure to meet somebody who's meditated daily.
Yes? Daily since 1969. 43 years.
43 years daily.
Yeah,
very good.
Yeah.
I only have you by 2 years.
It's a pleasure to meet somebody that's meditated even longer.
Pleasure, Robert. Folks, the book again. It's Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be. Subtitle, A Journey of Discovery, Snow, and Jazz in the Snow. Robert Forman. Robert, please, the website that's associated with the book.
The website associated with the book is Enlightenment Ain't. You're not allowed to use an apostrophe, so it's Enlightenment Ain't without the apostrophe.com. And then I also run an organization called the Forge Institute.
Spell it.
F-O-R-G-E. And we have a program that people might be interested in working, in hearing about. And the website for that is called Go Deeper Together. com.
Okay, Go Deeper Together. They could find you there.
They could, if they wrote a note there, or they can find enlightenmentaint.com, they can find me there too.
Okay, Enlightenment Ain't, A-I-N-T, mm-hmm. No apostrophe. Folks, that's how to be in touch with Robert. Brother, thank you so much for the time and the quality today.
Thank you. And I have one more comment, if I might.
Okay, yes.
And that is, what you're doing here, Tom, is really good work. There's much too much hype in the world. There's much too much superficiality. And you're attempting to have really good conversations with thoughtful people. And I know how hard it is to keep something like this going. And my hat is off to you. You do very good work.
Thank you,
brother. And thank you for doing it.
Thank you. It is a joy for me.
I bet.
Folks, thanks for joining us. Myself or Paul O'Brien will be back next week. Come on back. We'll have another Feast on Pathways next Sunday morning.
Yes, join us again next Sunday morning at 8:30 for another installment in the wonderful series of views and interviews as heard on the program Pathways. Stay tuned now for Het Hollands Uurtje. The Dutch Hour. This is KBOO Portland 90.7 on your FM dial. The following KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grandel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information can be gotten at 503-595-9550 or the facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.